Hello, this is Scott Wells for The Magic Word, and today my guest, all the way from Kent, Ohio, is Tom Craven. Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Nice lecture last night. I appreciate the crowd that you brought in.
Well, you're welcome. Yeah, we always have a good group here in Houston, and we're glad to have you. Had a lot of really good stuff that you were bringing in this year. Obviously, it's not your first rodeo. You've been lecturing for years and years.
Yeah, 1957 I started lecturing.
Now, wait a minute then. So the title of your book...
Wait a minute. Not 57. I'm sorry. I did my first lecture in 1977.
77. Okay.
Yes.
Just 20 years later. Okay. You were born in 57.
Yeah,
is that
well,
it?
Yeah. Well, wait, a little bit before that as well.
And hence the title of the book over there, a new book, My Almost 50 Years in Magic. So you got started then, I guess, when? In 60?
1963.
Three, okay. And that you, what was that actually first interested you in magic? I mean, what was it that grabbed your attention?
I got out of the service and 1957, that's when I got out of the service. And I put together a little basketball team in an independent league, and there was a guy there going to Kent State University from Chicago. We became really close friends, and one summer I visited him in Chicago, and his dad, who was 77 at the time, did some front and back palming things for me. And when his dad was 19, he did magic full time, traveled around the country with carnivals and so forth. So this friend of mine and I were big sports nuts. We used to go to the library and take out sports books. We could tell you everybody's lifetime batting average, ERAs, and all that kind of stuff. And once when we went to the library to take out some sports books, I noticed there were magic books in the same section. And my mind flashed back to when his dad was doing that for us in Chicago. And I thought, I think I'll just take out a magic book. And it just kind of went from there. The neighbors must have hated me because I would learn a new trick, and when I'd hear them drive in from work in the evening before they could even get in the house, I was over there
trying to
show them the next thing, you know.
Yeah.
So, but it kind of grew from there, and never imagined that it was going to grow into what it's become, but I don't think anybody ever realizes that when they get started.
How did you start producing or making your own tricks? I mean, you started obviously the right way, you know, of going and learning from books and going to the library and all that. And I guess in Kent, Ohio, there really weren't a lot of places for you to learn magic.
No, I was the only magician there as far as I know. But I was fortunate enough to join the Youngstown Magic Club, which is Ring 2 in the IBM. And I had a mentor there. His name was Jim Lee, who has now been deceased for about 15 years. But Jim Lee was one of the best card men that I've ever seen, and he kind of took me under his wing and gave me all the building blocks that I needed to do things the right way, and just went from there. And, you know, as far as learning things, to invent things, you know, I guess that if you spend enough time thinking about things, that ideas will pop into your head, and then you try them, and then you try them out on your audiences and see what works and what doesn't. But, you know, I've been fortunate to have had a lot of people in my magical life that have helped me along the way, and I think I can't give them enough credit, really.
But you really don't have necessarily a creative process of sitting down quietly or with a book. It's just things come to you.
Yeah, you know, when you're doing a trick, you think, but let's see, if I were to do this, maybe it would change the whole thing, and a lot of things happen that way. But I can't really tell you specifically how things pop into your mind. They just did over the years. Like in the book, there's 154 original tricks of mine in the book, and I never imagined that that there would be that many.
Actually. Were there things that you just had published, or maybe that you had somewhere in a computer, and eventually they just kept being added to, and that's why you decided to put them into
Much of it's been published. Apocalypse, Trapdoor, The Minotaur, some things in The Linking Ring. Not anything that was in my column, but much of it's been published. But there's a lot of stuff in the book that has never seen print except now in the book.
Let's go to The Linking Ring and talking about that, you've had the column Havenly Close-Up for 21 years?
21 years I did the Havenly Close-Up column, and that wasn't my idea for the name. I wanted to call it something else, but Phil Wilmarth named it. He was the editor of The Linking Ring at the time.
Or Howard Bamman. Was Howard or
I'm
Phil?
I'm sorry, Howard was the guy that started it, but Phil is the one who actually
named it.
Okay. The column.
Okay.
He took over shortly after I started doing the column.
Okay. Yeah. What was it called originally?
I didn't have a name.
Or?
No, I think Phil named it Havenly Close Up, and I think it was that right from the get go.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how he was in. I think he was an associate editor or something of that.
Yes, true.
Nature.
Back
yeah.
with me over Howard. Now, the close up column was just that. It didn't include cards because there were other card columns.
Well, the card corner was being done, and Howard Bamman was pretty adamant about not having card magic in my column because mm-hmm. he wanted it all good with Card Corner. However, after Phil Womark took over, he realized that card magic is close-up magic as well,
mm-hmm.
and he allowed me to put some card magic in there. Had very few over 21 years, I would say there might have been 20 card things in my column. The rest of it was all non-card magic.
Right. Now, Rick Johnson had a column coming a little closer for a long time, too. That overlapped yours, or
no,
you took
Rick,
his place?
After I took his place. Rick died, and there was a couple-of-year interim period where there was no close-up column. And one year at the Magi Fest, Ron Zollweg, who was a magician now deceased, he was from Utica, New York, Ron came to me and said, Tom, why don't you start writing the close-up column again? And I had never thought about doing that, but I did give it some thought, and I wrote to Howard Bamman, and he said, send me six columns. Once I have six columns in, then we'll see about doing it. He didn't want to have me start doing it and maybe send in a column or two, and then there wouldn't be any, and so forth. So
right.
I sent him six columns, and he agreed to go ahead and let me do the column. At one time, I was 36 months ahead.
Holy cow.
In the column.
And editor, you know, must have loved you.
Well, he did, but and I loved it too, because now if I didn't want to send in a column for a couple of months, I didn't have to worry
because
I had plenty of material already there. However, there were some contributors who weren't so happy because they send me something and
they're expecting to see it.
They expect to see it, and then maybe 2 years go by and then they see it.
Yeah.
I can give you a perfect example. Max Maven used to send me a thing every now and then, and at one point Max sent me a note that said, when I send you something, I would like to see it sooner rather than later. So
perfect.
Fortunately,
I
was able to, with Phil, send him something and say, I'd like to have this one in as soon as possible. Now, they're always 2 months pasted up, okay? So
yeah.
I can't get anything in until a third month from now. But I would tell him that I'd like it in as soon as possible, and in 3 months that would appear, which now pushed those other 36 columns back another month.
Right,
know,
yeah, so, you slip it in.
Yeah, so, but it was fun.
Over the years, what were some of the favorites or something that sticks out? It might be a trick or a contribution or...
Well, you know, as I said in the lecture last night, Michael DeMarco from Port Charlotte, New York sent me Port Chester, New York, he sent me a bunch of stuff, and he had a lot of really clever ideas, one of which I did in the lecture last mm-hmm. night with the little 16-square thing
and
with
dice.
The four dice. Michael originally sent me a trick that was a card trick he wanted in my column, and I had to tell him that I couldn't put it in. I could send it back. I could send it on to John, who was doing the close-up column at that time, the card corner at that time. And he said, do whatever you want with it. Keep it, use it in a lecture, use it yourself or whatever. So a couple of weeks later, I get a package from him, and he had 12 tricks in it that none of them were card magic. All
mm-hmm.
tricks with dice and coins and dominoes and all various sundry things, some mental things and so forth. So he's a clever guy.
And he continued over the years to send you.
Continued. And as I said last night, he would send me everything I needed to do every trick. Once he sent me a trick that used a half dollar with an expanded shell. He sent me the half dollar and the expanded shell.
Wow.
He sent me a trick once that used 14 $1 bills, and he sent me the 14 $1 bills. So occasionally, over the 21 years, I would write to Michael, since I didn't have email for him nor phone or anything. I would send him a letter that would say, it's about time to send me some more money tricks.
Yeah.
I was amassing all that money from Michael when he would
exactly.
send it to me.
Yeah, dozens of dollars.
But
you said you personally never met him shaking his hand. You wouldn't
never,
know if he was sitting next to you.
No, I wouldn't. And I wouldn't know, I have no idea what his age might be, whether he's young, he's old,
So he doesn't attend magic conventions, it sounds like, then, or any place, because you go to a lot.
I've never seen him at a convention. I don't know. I've seen tricks of his in the card corner subsequent to when he sent me his original trick, and I've seen tricks of his in the Precursor magazine and so forth. So he did a lot of contributing to various magazines, but I personally have never met him. Like I say, if he was sitting right here with me now, I wouldn't know who he was.
Yeah, well, that's funny. He must be. Well, as I recall, Rick Johnson was another guy who, I don't remember him attending a lot of conventions. Maybe he did, but he kind of kept a low profile. It was South Carolina or someplace, I think. And
Rick was in Asheville,
Raleigh,
North Carolina.
North Carolina.
And he eventually, once his name got out there a little bit, he started to attend some conventions. I booked Rick Johnson on his very first ever lecture.
Oh.
I was in Florida, and I had a magic shop down there, and Rick was expected in, and it was about time that he should have been here, and I was looking at my watch, and so finally I looked outside the front window, and parked in front of my shop, just up a bit, was this little tiny Triumph, which is an English automobile, and I could see Rick was sitting behind the wheel, and I went up there. And it was kind of funny because he was giving himself an insulin shot in his leg.
Uh-huh.
And he was busy doing that, and that's why he hadn't come in yet. But
that
little Triumph was just jam-packed with all his
wow.
stuff. So, but yeah, Rick was a good friend over the years.
Speaking of a shop, so you had a magic shop in Florida.
I had a magic shop for 7 years in Florida.
Whereabouts? Which city?
It was in Auburndale, which is between Winter Haven and Lakeland, or to expand that a bit more, it was between Tampa and Orlando.
Now, how were brick-and-mortar shops back in that day? And what years were that?
I opened the shop in 1977, sold it in 1984 when I moved back to Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
But there were a lot of, I mean, I was the only one in Auburndale, of course, because it's a town of about 7,000 people.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of magic shops around. I mean, Jeff White had one in Tampa, Martin Ells had one in St. Petersburg, and Don Masters had one in Orlando. So there were, and of course, Harry and Irv had theirs over in Daytona. And of course, Paul Diamond was down south. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of brick and mortar, and not only in Florida, but everywhere.
Sure.
It's not like today is what's happened today.
Right, right. And why did you decide to sell or move out? And
well, I had been divorced. And I was on a lecture tour up in Ohio, and a lady that before I was married, I went with for a while, and we almost got married, and that was a long, long time before that. I had worked with her brother, and I ran into him, and I said to him, how's Nancy doing? And he said, she's doing great. She's divorced now. You ought to give her a call. So I did. I gave her a call, and we kind of hooked up again, and I was in Florida. She was in Ohio. She was not about to move to Florida because she had about 25 or 26 years working for a doctor and had a retirement that was building, and she wasn't about to leave all of that. So I sold the shop and moved back to Ohio.
And then stayed there ever since in Kent.
I've been there ever since, yeah. I moved back in 84. And
you worked for a while with the baseball team?
I worked for a computer company actually for 10 years, and they sold out, and the company wanted to move me to somewhere in Pennsylvania, and I said, no, I'm not going to do that. So I was without a job, and I had an ad in the paper of a job fair, so I went to the job fair and turned in a whole bunch of resumes, and one of them was a local baseball team that was located in Canton, Ohio, which is about 25 minutes from me, but they were building a brand new stadium in Akron, which was 11 miles from me, and they were moving from Canton to Akron, and they were looking to get their staff put together. So,
like a PR person or what?
No, I worked in group sales.
Okay.
And I'll tell you a funny story is I Before that, I interviewed at a bank. I had worked for a finance company before I even moved to Florida, and I was in a credit and collection background because of working for the finance company.
Yeah.
I interviewed at a bank. They were looking for somebody in their credit department, and I went in, and the lady talked to me about all the benefits and everything else and said, would you like to meet the rest of the staff? And I said, sure. So she took me in, introduced me to everybody. We came out, and she said to me, now, is there anything that you would like to ask me? And I said, nope, you've explained everything pretty well. So I left and got a letter from them that they would keep my resume on file, but they weren't going to hire me, okay?
Yeah.
So between that interview with the bank and my interview with the baseball team, the Senior Citizens Council of Akron had a full-page ad in the Lincoln Ring, and they told how to interview, because a lot of people hadn't interviewed, you know, if you're a senior citizen.
Yes.
And the very bottom thing that they said was, always ask, when can I start? And then a bell went off. I said, that's what that lady wanted me to ask, when can I start? I'm thinking now
that was it.
So when I get called in to do the interview for the baseball team, the guy who was interviewing me, the vice president of the team, said to me, now, Tom, there'll be a lot of telephone work. Does that bother you? And I said, no, you know, I was in credit and collections for a long time, and that wouldn't bother me at all. When can I start? And then he said, you're going to have a lot of contact with the public. Are you shy about doing that? And I said, hey, I've been, you know, I do this magic thing.
Man.
I'm great with the public. When can I start? And after every question, I answered it and said, when can I start? They concluded the interview. I went home. I wasn't home 15 minutes. And I got a call from them that said, we want you to work for us. We've never had anybody want to start a job so bad in their life. So it was kind of funny. And I never forgot about that.
Good advice.
Yeah, right.
Got a call for the close of the sale.
Boy, I want to tell you, that was good.
That's the same thing I think, you know, for magicians, whenever they're calling us about doing a show, that you don't want them necessarily to call around everybody else. If they say, well, I'm just shopping for price, you know, you know, and trying to find a magician or whatever, said, I don't think you need to call anybody else. You know, you probably should say, you know, can I send you a contract? You know, what's your address? Let me send you a contract, and let's get this thing going, you know.
That's it.
And I think it's important that they have something in hand, and if they have that contract, then they're more than likely going to sign that rather than waiting to have someone else send them a contract. I mean, they may call somebody else, but if they have that email from you within a half hour after calling you with a copy of a contract, they're, you know, more than likely going to hire you, I think.
Yeah, that's good.
Do you use contracts, by the way, speaking of that, when you perform?
On occasion I do, but many of the times I don't. When I'm doing shows around home, I know most of the people that I'm doing the shows for.
So, it's just a handshake.
I've had a personal relationship with them.
Right.
Now, when I'm working for, like, Joe Leffler, for instance, books me quite often, and Joe always gets a contract signed, and I get a copy of that. I have to sign it, send it back to him.
Right.
And Mike Bishop in Canton, who is a hypnotist mainly, but he books me quite often as well, and of course he uses contracts as the agent.
Mm-hmm,
so.
Mm-hmm.
But
and of course you do trade shows or hospitality suites, and I guess the companies that you.
When I was in Florida for those 7 years, I was doing about 22 to 23 trade shows a year for Scotty's, which was the largest home building store. It's like Lowe's and Home Depot and that now.
Yeah,
but they were the only one in Florida for a long time, and so they were very well known.
They're out of business now, I guess.
They still have some stores, but they're almost like discount stores now.
Okay,
Nothing like they were at all, because Lowe's and Home Depot and those things have come in and taken away a lot of their clientele.
So. Same thing like with bookstores, you know, Barnes & Noble, you know, it kind of taken over the mom and pop type of bookstore, smaller bookstores, Interesting. Talk about the brick and mortar shops and everything then as well. Now, close up, that of course, by having a magic shop that you did a little bit of everything, and we were talking last night about how that people have commented on your how much they enjoy the stage show. I didn't know that you did the stage show, because I always think of you being a close-up guy because of the 21 years magic of doing just the close-up column. So what is your favorite? I assume that you like cards perhaps best.
I do like cards. I've always told people, you know, a lot of people don't like card tricks. But I think, and I've always told people, there's a big difference between card tricks and card magic. You know, I find that if you can do some card magic for people and make them have a good time and they enjoy what they're seeing, then they like card magic.
Sure.
You know, their Uncle Joe did a card trick for them, and, you know, somebody like that doesn't
do it well.
Yeah,
laid out three rows of cards.
And they may have to reset and get started again to keep showing it to them, but that kind of thing. So I think that's what turns a lot of people off as far as card tricks are concerned. But like I say, I think card magic can be just as entertaining as any other type of magic if it's done right.
Right. And on stage, what is your favorite type of effects or that you'd like to do?
Well, I do a 9-minute act.
Silent act? Or is it talking
act? It's all to music.
Music, okay.
That I've done at conventions, and I did it at the TOM in 84. And when they hired me back again in 88 to work the TOM, I was requested to do that act again on stage. So I did that, and as I said last night to you, Paul Diamond came to me and said, "Wow, I didn't know you did anything but close-up." You know, so it's kind of funny. But I don't do that act much anymore because the setup is a little bit cumbersome. If you're at a dinner party, a corporate dinner party, and they want you to do strolling before dinner and then a show afterwards for everybody. But I do an act now that has it's not music, it's all patter and so
when you work in people's homes for parties, private events, things like that, I assume you kind of do some strolling, but do you also do a stand-up act like in front of the fireplace or
if they want that, I do that. Yeah. Okay. And it gets pretty hot in some of those fireplaces.
Yeah, but it's cold up in the north, up in Ohio, so you got to stay warm.
Exactly.
Warm by the fire.
Yeah.
I like the effect, for an example, without tipping anything, you know, what you did with the phone call, you know, that you teach in the lecture. That's a great stand-up routine.
And
too.
I do that at parties a lot when I'm when I'm there. As a matter of fact, as I said last night, a friend of mine now outside of Dallas, Doug Canning, I used to get phone calls in the middle of the night at 2 o'clock in the morning, and the guy on the other end of the line would say, "Hey, I'm at a party with Doug Canning, and I selected a card, and he tells me you can tell me what it is." He and I had a lot of phone tricks that we did over the years.
Right.
And he was single at the time. I was married, but so he went to a lot of parties. And
you got these late-night calls.
Made me a lot of late-night calls, right.
Let's talk about your book a little bit, My Almost 50 Years in Magic over here. Now, I know from my own experience, it does take a long time to put together a book. And obviously, this had taken nearly 50 years of experience. But as far as putting it together, how long has it been to making it?
I started on September 7th of 2010.
So he remembers specifically.
That's my wife's birthday.
Oh, okay.
But I started on September 7th. About 5 or 6 years ago, I had the idea to put together a book.
Yeah.
And my wife thought that was a great idea. My daughter said, my youngest daughter, she said, "Gosh, that's great, Dad. You know, I think you really should do that." And so I sat down and started to think about all the stuff that I had come up with, and it overwhelmed me at the time. And I just put it off and didn't get the book started. So now 5 or 6 years go by, and that September 7th of 2010, I woke up and I said, if I'm ever going to do the book, I've got to get it started. And I did.
Yeah.
And
so you sat down at the computer and started?
Sat down at the computer. Much of the stuff, as I said, had been in print, so I get out all the Apocalypse magazines, all of the trapdoors and precursors, and and I'm looking through and getting my stuff and just copying it from what was in, you know, in those write-ups. And the rest of the stuff I just had to put in my own words and so forth. But I finished the book in the end of May. And I spent a lot of time from September 7th to May at the computer doing it. And finally got it finished and got it sent off, and you have the final result here.
And
now,
you said you only printed 500 copies, so there's going to be a limited edition.
I won't ever have it reprinted because obviously I still have a lot of copies I'm trying to get rid of. But I sold a lot. I sold almost 100 copies pre-sale, and Murphy's Magic took 150. And I've sold a bunch at lectures and so forth. But I think everybody who I know who wants the book, who are friends of mine who I think might want the book, has already purchased the book from me, either pre-sale or later. So I think the only way I'm going to sell books from now on, with except for an occasional one or two possibly here and there, are at lectures and maybe at conventions.
And if people want to buy that, can they order it online? You got a website? Or
I don't have a website anymore, but my email address is vipmagic@AOL. And obviously, if they just drop me an email.
And they're $75 plus shipping? Or what's the...
Actually, you know, I've been... the book retails for $75, and I made Murphy's the exclusive... They're the
distributor,
jobber.
Jobber, right.
They're the exclusive wholesale distributor. So I'm not wholesaling the book, but I'm trying to get rid of them. So I'm selling the book for $50. If somebody wanted one, you know, I would do that.
So you drop you an email about that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I noticed that also, when you said that you had copied this from the different magazines from which they appeared, that there appear to be different illustrations or illustrators who have made things. Plus, some are photographs, some are illustrations.
Yeah, and that was what was in the original. I would scan those from the original publication.
Yeah, whoever it was that
had
drawn that.
So they're not. I didn't have an illustrator re-illustrate all the stuff.
Yeah, Tony Dunn or anybody.
Yeah. No, I didn't go to that expense.
Mm-hmm. And so was it pretty rewarding? I mean, after you finished that, how'd you feel?
I think so. I think it's a nice-looking book.
Yeah.
I was very pleased with the way it came out. You know, I've had a lot of comments from people that that they think it's a nice book. It's got good-sized print. It's easy to read. And that was one of the comments I got from a lot of people that, you know, they buy books and the print's so small and they have trouble reading it. So I'm very pleased with the way the book came out.
Right, right. And so it has it been reviewed much in the publications? Have you seen anything?
It may be reviewed in places like the Magic Cafe. And
but not in the Linking Ring or Genie or Magic or anywhere you've seen yet?
No. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because it's fairly new. It came out when?
It came out in July.
Okay.
So just 4 months ago.
Right.
Or
so a lot of times they got a backlog of other publications there, so it may be coming out.
And I didn't send any anywhere for review.
Murphy's often does.
Probably do that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So maybe seeing something soon in the magazines coming out.
Yeah,
so.
Maybe so.
Yeah, so they should be available at your local from your local dealer through Murphy's. A lot of people could probably pick it up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I like the laminated cover as opposed to the paperback, you know, cover and a hardback. That just it looks slick, you know. I can wipe it off.
And it eliminates the dust jacket and everything. But I was very pleased. And my granddaughter, one of my granddaughters, gave me the idea for the film strip animation thing on the front cover and on the back.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very pleased with the way that
very attractive
out.
And so I was going to also ask about other lectures that, again, you've been lecturing for a long number of years, and so you've got, I know from here that you're leaving to, after Houston, you got San Antonio tonight and Austin, then you head back to Ohio, and then next year, I mean, what plans are in the future? What have you got going?
Well, I don't know. I just...
next 50 years.
Yeah, right. As I said, I just recently lectured in Buffalo and Syracuse, New York, and up in Maine, and Hilton Head, South Carolina, and now I'm on this tour here. I don't have anything else planned as far as magical lecture tours are concerned, but if I want to get rid of some more books, I'm gonna get some
carry
more lecture tours going. Yeah.
Any suggestions, advice do you have for young people? Anybody who's getting into magic or
I still think that books are one of the best buys that you can do in magic. I know the young crowd today are enamored with DVDs and that type of thing. I mean, they went from the VHS tapes to DVDs and that, and they would much rather look at somebody else doing it than to read about it. But I still think that if you read a book, you can find some good stuff, and when you then put that trick into your own repertoire, it's going to be your personality that's in it, as opposed to a lot of the guys, they do it exactly the way they see it on the DVD. And so, therefore...
They become clones.
They haven't put themselves into it. And I don't think that's a good thing. I still think books are one of the best ways to go. I won't ever change that in the young crowd, but...
Yeah, well, that was something Roger Clouse had told me many years ago. Your best investment in magic is in books, you know. And people say practice, 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 but he would say read, read, read.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So I think that is very important. Well, then closing, then let me say that, of course, the podcast is called The Magic Word. What would be your magic word? What would you leave us with as Tom Craven's magic word?
Well, I'll tell you, the one thing that I always try to do for my audiences is to make them have fun. So I would say I'll use fun.
Fun.
My magic word.
That's great. Tom, thank you very much. I appreciate you being here and coming by Houston and going on this tour. I know that you're leaving in your wake, you know, a lot of really good magicians who have learned a lot of really good stuff. And, you know, you've helped a lot of people. And I forgot really, hadn't talked about the 4F convention, you know, Effectors Finger Flicking Frolic, yeah. You know, that you were back in 87, I think you were the guest of honor, you know.
Something like that.
Yeah.
I keep losing track of that myself.
Of time. But if somebody did want to contact you or just say hello or, you know, buy a book or something, again, it's VIP, like very important person, VIPmagic
at
AOL.com.
At AOL. And if they're an IBM member, they can go back to the Linking Ring prior to September of this year. And at the end of my column, I always had my email address, my home address, and my phone number.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Always get in contact with you.
Any of those means to contact me is just fine.
Great. Tom, thank you very much. I appreciate it a lot. So for now, this is going to be Scotty out.